We're talking about messy ministry. And so when we talk about messy ministry, we're talking about reaching the people, the very people that Jesus reached, and creating the kind of church environment that the friends of Jesus would feel welcomed at. And I'm going to begin by giving you a definition of messy ministry. And I'm sorry that I don't have slides, but I'll just I'll repeat it if you want to write it down. Here's my definition for you as we begin. Messy ministry is the display of God's mercy and justice toward those who are very far from Him. So messy ministry has two parts to it. It is this display of God's mercy and justice toward those who are far from God. Well, lest we forget, I'm going to set the stage by reminding us that Jesus had His own personal purpose statement. In other words, when Jesus came to the earth, He said, "Let me tell you why I'm here." You all know it, Luke chapter 19, verse 10. "For the Son of Man came to do what? Came to seek and save the lost." So what are the lost? Well, perhaps the most sobering description of what it means to be lost is that these are people who are unregenerate. They don't have the Spirit of God within them. And the Bible tells us that every person has a soul that ends up in one of two places, either heaven or hell. So as Jesus approached Jerusalem, the text tells us that He weeps. And what does He say? He says, "I wish I could have gathered you together." It's all this very mothering language. "As a mother hen gathers her chicks, but you are unwilling to do so." And He weeps over the lostness of the people. If we claim to be followers of Jesus, then we should have the heart of Jesus. Are we weeping over the lostness of the people that are around us, the people in our cities? It almost seems that Jesus had a preferred type of person that not only were drawn to Him, but He was actually drawn to them, and realized that Jesus saved His harshest words for people who went to the churches of their choosing essentially every week. Jesus saved His harshest words for the people that had memorized large portions of their Bible, if you will, the Old Testament, right? Who are we talking about? Jesus saved His harshest words for religious people. But it was the people that were outside of the church, that were people that were far from Him. The Pharisees were far from God in their own way, but they didn't see it. But these people that would be considered the least of these had this attraction to Jesus. And so what I want to bring to you today is this idea: what would it look like for your church to be filled with the friends of Jesus? Because in many churches today, the environment is rather like this room. What do you mean by clean?
Organized, yeah. Put together.
Yeah. We all look good. Yeah. You're beautiful people. We all smell good. Especially here, no one in this room is worried about where your next meal is going to come from. We've consumed too many calories this week. What would it look like for your church to be the kind of environment that sees those people coming through its doors continuously? You have to be very intentional to do this, because it will not happen. We tend to be very homogeneous in our gatherings. And you look around the room and you realize the people that were drawn to Jesus are in many ways unlike the people that are drawn to us. And so what are we doing about that? So we're going to look at the ministry of Jesus, we're going to look at the ministry of Paul, and then we're going to get very practical, and I'm going to walk you through some of the ways in which we do it at our church, and then we'll interact on it, okay? So this will be a two-way conversation. So let's begin with the ministry of Jesus. We'll look at Him as the example. Jesus is the example of all things. We're going to look at some Bible passages, so if you have your Bibles, go ahead and open them, or if you have them on your app or on your phone. We're going to start with Matthew chapter 11 and verse 19. This is the way in which Jesus was perceived by those who were religious. Matthew chapter 11 and verse 19. If at any time I'm not clear on something, please stop me. Raise your hand and I will attempt to make it clear. Matthew chapter 11, verse 19. Let's read it together. "The Son of Man came eating and drinking. And they say, 'Look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.'" Very interesting that they specify a specific group, tax collectors. Now, some of you may know that this was an insult, right? This is an insult. And here's why. This is the part that you may not know. The Romans were very smart about how they collected money, through taxes specifically. They didn't come knocking on your door, as the tax collector, tax man would, as you think. Instead, they put the collection of taxes out to bid. So wealthy people would arrive, and they would bid over provinces. Who wants to collect taxes in the province of whatever? Then the wealthy people would bid, and then the highest bidder would then be given official papers from the Roman government. That gave them permission to knock on your door, if you lived in that province, or if you ran a business, and say, the tax man is here. Well, how much do I owe? How much do you have? So the idea was to collect far more in money than what you had paid when you put out to bid. So they were notorious cheats. So this is a specific group that is identified by the Pharisees as being social outcasts, as being undesirable. So question, in your context, who are the tax collectors? Tell me.
Politicians.
Excellent. That's a great one. Politicians. Who else? How about those in the LGBTQ community? Would they fit that definition by some people in your church? Okay, good. The Catholic Church?
But I mean the hierarchy.
Yeah, the hierarchy. Yeah, yeah, good. Mm-hmm. So Jesus gets this label, tax collector, but he was called a friend of sinners. What does it mean to you to know that Jesus was called a friend of sinners? The fact that you're saved?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
We can be a friend of sinners too.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We can be a friend of sinners? The sinners, yes. I like what this brother said. If we are going to reach those who are far from God, we must first see ourselves as having been lost. The fact that Jesus was a friend of sinners means that he is your friend. You understand what I'm saying? You understand what I did there? If we are going to reach people far from God, and Jesus was a friend of sinners, what I'm telling you is, that means he's your friend. Why do I say that? Because you are a sinner saved by grace. One of the things that prevents us from stepping into messy ministry is this idea that, well, again, the Pharisees had it. God, thank you that I am not like. If you are leading a church or any organization and your attitude does not begin with the fact that Jesus was a friend of sinners, that means he's your friend, then your organization, your church, will never be one that truly has a heart to reach those who are far from God. So it starts with realizing that you are a sinner saved by grace. How about this example, Luke chapter 7, verse 38, beginning with verse 36. One of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and reclined at table. And behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at table in the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster flask of ointment. So the fact that this ointment is in an alabaster flask tells us that it was very expensive. And standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wipe them with the hair of her head. And then she began, you have to picture this scene. She began kissing his feet and anointed them with the ointment. Now, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, he's thinking this to himself, he isn't necessarily speaking this out loud, but what's interesting is that when Jesus responds, he responds because he knows the man's thoughts. If this man were a prophet, this is what he's thinking, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him. Why? Because she is a sinner. So obviously Pharisees had no interactions with sinners because they were dirty and they were unclean. And rather than have a heart of compassion toward this lady who is broken, of the city was a phrase that was commonly used to describe someone who is immoral. We don't know exactly. According to tradition, They have her as a prostitute, but the text doesn't say explicitly. But why does she anoint him? She does this because she recognizes him as the Messiah King. And she seems to be the only one in the room to do so. She is socially unacceptable within the religious community. If I could go back in time and listen to one parable from Jesus, it would be the parable where he is asked the question, "Who is my neighbor?" Do you remember this? I'll summarize it for you. So a man is walking along a dangerous path. He gets beat. He gets robbed. He's left for dead. Two religious people pass by him. And what do? They go around their way, not wanting to get involved. Clearly, he needs help. And then Jesus adds the hero, and it's a Samaritan. And if you could have gone back in time, and when Jesus heard Jesus speak the words, the Samaritan, who is half Jewish, half Samaritan, Jesus takes a half-breed whom Jews hate. Good God-fearing Jews refused to step foot on Samaritan soil because if they did, it would make them unclean, and then they would have to go through a ritualization ceremony to become clean again. They didn't step foot on the soil. A Samaritan comes by and helps him. Jesus takes the socially unacceptable and makes him the hero of his story. And then, right, he says, who is more of a neighbor to this guy? And the guy can't even bring himself to say it was the Samaritan. He says, it's the guy that helped him. So Jesus had this way about him of communicating and embracing people that others find very, very difficult. I'll give you one last one here from Matthew chapter 8, the leper. When he came down, Matthew chapter 8, beginning with verse 1, when he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him, and behold, a leper came to him and knelt before him. So this is pretty unusual in and of itself, because you may know that back in the day, if a leper was approaching anyone in public, they would have to declare unclean, unclean, unclean. They would literally have to scream this in order for the crowds to disperse so that they could make their way through. And behold, the leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, if you will, you can make me clean." And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, "I will be clean." And immediately his leprosy was cleaned. When you read the Bible, there are very important details that the author intended to include to teach you something about Jesus. And the context tells us everything. One thing that we might not know is that back in the day, to touch a leper was absolutely unheard of. Because back in the day, many believed that that's how you got leprosy, just by touching somebody. And so what does Jesus do? He touches him. Now, for a leper, remember social distancing? Remember that time? That was a leper's entire life, was social distancing, and more than 6 feet. And so Jesus could have, from a distance, said to him, "Be clean, I'll heal you." But instead, what does he do? He touches him. And the thing that lepers most wanted was physical contact. It may have been years before this man had ever had that kind of physical contact. And so what does Jesus do to the socially unacceptable? Not only does he heal him, but he gives him exactly what he needs, and that is dignity. So this is the way of Jesus, and church leader, what I would say to you is that if we claim to have the heart of Jesus, then we must ask ourselves these questions. So I'm going to put it to you. Who are the lepers that you are touching? If you're not touching the leper, so to speak, then we probably need to reevaluate our ministry. Ministry of Paul, quickly. There's a saying that you're probably familiar with. Ministry is great if it wasn't for the... Do you know this saying? Ministry is fantastic. It's wonderful if it wasn't for the...
People.
Ministry is excellent. It's just the doggone people that are so difficult. Here's Paul's experience. Maybe you can relate. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 1. He says, "But I, brothers, could not address you as spiritual people, but as people of the flesh, as infants in Christ." Now, he's speaking to people who are in the church. "I fed you with milk, not solid food, because you were not ready for it. And even now you are not ready, for you are still of the flesh. For while there is jealousy, strife among you, are you not of the flesh and behaving only in a human way? He gives them an example. He says, this is to back up my point. There's jealousy amongst you. There's strife. There's quarreling. There are divisions among you. You're acting in a human way. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 4. For when one says, I follow Paul, and another, I follow Apollos. Apollos, I don't know if it's this way in Europe, but in the United States, we have quite a few celebrity pastors. You know what I'm talking about? Is that the case in Europe? Not so much. Okay. Well, good for you. We have a lot of celebrity pastors in America. Who's your pastor? I follow. Oh, I know him. Yeah, but this is my pastor. Oh, I've seen his YouTube channel. Yeah. There's nothing new. Paul describes these believers as fleshly, babies, jealous. There's conflict, behaving in human ways rather than spiritual. So we are considered sheep. And sheep what? They bite. Sheep bite. And sometimes sheep bite each other. But sometimes sheep will turn and bite who? Their shepherds. Have you ever been bit? It hurts. It hurts emotionally. And there's this sense in being in ministry where you're leading God's people. You're like, I'm just trying to help you. Here's my heart. Why are you biting me? At our church, amongst the leadership team, we have a saying, another saying. Good shepherds smell like sheep. You like that? Good shepherds smell like sheep. So if you don't smell like sheep, you're not a good shepherd. Shepherds actually, have you ever seen when shepherds, you all know about this better than I do in here in Europe, shepherds, when they lead sheep, they don't lead them from the front. They don't lead them from the back. Where do they lead them? They actually lead them from the side. They lead them from the side. And they're very, very close. And sheep are very interesting animals. You know, they're one of the few creatures that cannot survive on their own. If sheep are not led to clean water, they will drink from dirty water. Sheep have to be led to places where they can feed. It's a very interesting animal, and I think God created this species to help us understand who we are. We are sheep. We have to be led. So if you are in leadership, what I'm telling you is own your authority. That's God-given authority. The sheep need you to lead them. Lead them well. Without your leadership, they will die of thirst. Without your leadership, they will eat all the wrong things. There was something that Renee said this morning. It was a great phrase. He said, lukewarm water is determined by its environment. And as leaders, we create the environments in which the sheep that God has entrusted to us, we create the environment. As shepherds, we feed them, we lead them, and we protect them. And this is the ministry of Paul. And so at times, Paul, when he writes, he's like, Paul, that sounds very, very difficult. Well, he's actually shepherding them. Well, a couple more quickly. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 21. For in eating, each one goes ahead with his own meal. In other words, he's saying, you know, it's kind of like the buffet here in the Red Restaurant. Everybody's just going for it. There's no deference toward one another. Nobody's really caring about one another. They just want to make sure they get fed. One goes hungry, right, because all the food has been taken. And then there's this other guy over in the corner, and he's drunk, and probably he's getting drunk off of communion wine. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1 and 2. It is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and of a kind that is not tolerated even among pagans. What does it look like? A man has his father's wife, and you are arrogant. Ought you not rather to mourn? Let him who has done this be removed from among you. This is incest inside of the local church. And the response of the church members, because they haven't been led well locally, the response of the church members is like this. Look at us. Look at this incestuous relationship. We are so proud of it because we are open and we are tolerant and we affirm everything. And Paul says, you shouldn't be celebrating. you should be crying. And then he brings an important principle to bear. He reveals that the justice of God is real and that sin is real. And he says, I'll tell you how it needs to be dealt with. This brother needs to be removed from the fellowship. In the ministry of Jesus, you see two things coming together that form a powerful influence upon those who are far from God. And before I get there, I want to read one last example from John 13. And this is the example of Jesus of how we can lead in the messiness of the people that are around us. It says, now before John chapter 13, verse 1. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God, was going back to God. And he rose from supper, laid aside his outer garments, and taking a towel, tied it around his waist. And then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. This is, by the way, one of the very first lessons Jesus gives to the church, is to teach them, by example, how to humbly, lovingly, and sacrificially serve other people. And so at this point, you might be familiar with the text. I'll summarize it. We're all captivated by Peter's response, because what does Peter say? Lord, what are you doing? You should never wash my feet. And Jesus says, yeah, but if I don't wash your feet, then you have no part of me. And Jesus responds, then wash my whole body. There's this conversation that happens where Jesus says, Peter, you're going to deny me three times. And knowing that Peter would deny him three times, after having given him his full commitment, what does Jesus do? And he washes his feet. There will be people in your ministry who tell you, Pastor, church leader, I'm in. I am all in. And then all of a sudden something happens. You do something they don't like. There's a decision that's made. Or they choose to leave. And they don't even tell you why. Or they withhold funds. Or they begin to talk about you. And there's some gossip that spreads. It's going to happen. And Jesus calls us to serve even those who will betray us. Isn't it interesting? If Judas is in the room at this time, the text says that after the meal, Judas immediately left. So based on the timing, if Judas is still in the room, Jesus washes his feet too. And if that's the case, that takes this conversation to another level. One last interaction. John chapter 8. Early in the morning, the beginning of verse 2, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and they place her in their midst. So now, imagine her embarrassment and imagine her shame in front of this group of men. They said to him, Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Very interesting that the man is not there, but only she is. Now, in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say? But this whole thing is a test. This, they said, to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him, because he kept telling the Pharisees that they didn't know God, they wanted to get rid of him. And this is a very clever test, they think, because they have Jesus between what we say in America, the phrase is between a rock and a hard place, right? Because if Jesus says, yes, She has violated the law, and the Old Testament law tells us to stone her. Stone her. If he agrees with the law of Moses, then he is at odds with Roman law, because the Jews were given a lot of freedom to practice their religion. One thing they could not do was carry out the death penalty. So if Jesus says, yes, let's take her outside the city and stone her, then they'll report him to the Jews as one who should be arrested for committing murder. But if he disagrees with the law of Moses, he says, well, Moses didn't really mean that. Then all of a sudden, well, you don't follow the prophet Moses. You're a false prophet. We knew it. So it seems that Jesus is stuck. Jesus is never stuck. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. According to the Talmud, which is a commentary on the Torah, the rabbis allowed for a Jew to write in the dust. You could not write with an ink pen on the Sabbath because that was doing a work. But you could take your finger and you could write in the dirt on the Sabbath, because eventually the wind would blow it away and it didn't last forever. But ink lasted forever. That was doing a work. You can't do any work on the Sabbath. So this is very interesting contextually. So now Jesus takes his finger and he's writing on the ground. What does he write? We don't know. And I don't actually think that's the most important part of this. Ben writes with the finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and he said to them, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. So rabbis retained their authority by never answering a question directly. Did you know that? This is why when Jesus was asked a question, he would never answer it. He would put it in the form of a question back to them. You know, who is my neighbor? Well, I'll tell you a story. He would respond, here, I have a question about the law. Well, you read the law. What does it say to you? So he never directly answered a question. A way of a rabbi retaining his authority. So that's what he does here. But he does this odd thing. He makes a statement, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone here. Now, this is pretty profound. And once more, he bent down and wrote on the ground. Again, what did he write? We don't know. But here's the point, verse 9. When they heard it. So it wasn't so much about what they saw necessarily. It's about what they heard him say. Fine. Okay. Let me throw it back on you. Since you are our adherents of Mosaic law, here's a stone. Who wants to begin? The first who is without sin. When they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. Why? Probably because they had more sense than to stick around and try to make that an argument. The younger ones would. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Verse 10, Jesus stood up and said to her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? She said, no one, Lord. And Jesus said, neither do I condemn you. Go. And from now on, sin no more. There's an important principle here, and it applies to the unpleasant people you want to have come through your doors. Okay? And the principle, as stated by Jesus, is this. Essentially, he says, I'm not here to condemn you. But at the same time, I don't condone what you do. Does that translate? I'm not here to condemn you, but at the same time, I don't condone what you do. So she would expect him, because Jesus is a rabbi, to give his judgment, his condemnation of her, but he withholds it. Why? Because Jesus actually came to take her and your condemnation upon himself. It's a big difference. I'm not here to condemn you. He's like, I'm actually here to take your condemnation. That's how good I am. It's an important principle to get across. That's what Jesus came to do. But at the same time, he says, I don't condone everything you do. Okay, so let me give you a practical example. In my ministry setting, not long ago, and we've had this happen quite frequently at our church, and I'll explain why this happens frequently at our church, because I think this is actually a good sign of health for any church. But after one of the services, we have three services on a Sunday morning. After one of the services, a couple approached me, a lesbian couple. And they said, we love the church. We love the church. And everybody is so friendly. Everybody is so friendly. And we love being here. And we want to know, what does the church believe about our relationship? Yeah. So it's a very difficult situation to be in that moment. And what you say in that moment is very important, because people will gauge who you are as a representative of the entire church or your Christian organization, and they will make a decision on whether or not they're going to stay. So what you say in that moment is very, very important. And so I usually say something like this when this happens. I say, you know, first of all, thank you for being here, and tell me how you got here. And in this case, they were invited by a lady whom I know, and she's a disciple. She's a firm believer in Jesus Christ. And I knew that she had invited this couple because she believed that her church would receive them in the proper way. And I said, I'm glad you're here. And I said, at this church, Jesus is our example in all things. And so we are not here to condemn you, because if we were to condemn you, we would have to condemn everybody. And because we follow Jesus, Jesus is the one who took our condemnation upon himself. Okay? This is the story of the cross. I said, at the same time, as Jesus is our example, we don't approve of everything. We don't condone everything. And I want to tell you that there is sexual brokenness and sexual dysfunction in everybody's life. So I'm not just speaking to you right now, I'm speaking to myself. There is some measure of sexual brokenness from my past, probably in my future. Every person in this church has some measure of sexual brokenness. So I want you to know that when you enter into this room, it's really not about the relationship that you have together. It's about something much larger that we are all gathered here to receive. And as you come, you're going to hear the Bible taught. And for everybody in the room, there are going to be things they hear, and it's going to feel like sandpaper. You know what sandpaper is? It's going to feel like sandpaper. There are things I read that I hear, and it's going to feel like sandpaper. I don't want to hear that. And that's the Word of God smoothing over the things in our lives for which He doesn't desire. I'm really glad you're here. I'd love to talk about this with you and have further conversations with you. But I want to be upfront with you. And I want to be very candid with you. And I want to let you know. I'm giving you a direct answer to your question. Because here's another thing about messy ministry. Clarity is kindness. You understand what I'm saying? Be clear and be upfront. And I have learned the hard way because I have done it wrong. I've been in situations where I'm like, you know what, I'm not really going to speak directly to this. Well, it'll all just work out. At least they're here. And then what happens is you're teaching through a text and they hear you say it. And all of a sudden they feel, you didn't tell me. You never told me. And I gave you the opportunity to. And you're dishonest. And I don't trust you. And then you know what they're going to do? They're going to go down to the street and they're going to attend my friend's Methodist church, where they will be affirmed and they will be included, right? I had a conversation with a progressive pastor and literally said to me, we receive the people that other churches reject and we welcome them and we become their family. And I said, and you keep them lost. And you keep them lost. Now here's the thing. Jesus said that if you give anything up in my name, I'll give it to you what? 100-fold. So this is why, and I'm just using one example here, I could use many others, in the LGBTQ, what's it called? LGBTQ community. It's really not as much of a community as you think it is. There's actually not a lot of, they don't really get along too well. But what they have in common is rejection. And what they form in their rejection is a family of people who have been rejected. And the thing that unites a group will determine the quality of that group. You see what I'm saying? The thing that unites a group or any two people will determine the quality of that group. What is it that unites Christians? Jesus. You can't get better quality than that. What is it that that unites that community? Well, we've all been rejected. That's a very weak glue. Jesus said, if you give anything up in my name, I'll give it to you 100-fold. What's happening is the church family must be a family that is 100 times better than that family. You understand what I'm saying? Because what the church needs to know is that's not really much of a family. It's not. So now the challenge is, as a leader, you understand this. How do you get your people to understand it? That's two very different things. So I was very, very happy, very proud that this lady had invited, these two ladies were from the gym. And she felt that this was, her church was a place where these women could come and be accepted. So let me tell you the rest of that story. So they attend for a little while, and they want to get involved in different ways in the church. And we can have that discussion during a Q&A time, too, because that might be important. How do you involve people that are kind of unpleasant? How do you involve them in the life of your church? What's appropriate and what's not? These are important issues for two reasons. Number one, when someone comes to me and has these concerns or has these particular struggles or temptations, about three-fourths of them, in my experience, have been raised in the church. Do you realize that? About three-fourths have been raised in the church. So I immediately assume you have some church background, and there's probably some church hurt. You probably heard something. Maybe you came out, and all of a sudden you've been rejected, and now you're putting your toes back in the water to see what happens. The vast majority of people in that community were raised in the church. Secondly, the way in which your congregation responds to these people is as important as your response. And like I said, that's another subject, and we'll get to that in a second. But I want to go back to the principle. Okay, the principle is this: essentially, we're saying we're not here to condemn you, but at the same time, we don't condone everything that is done, and that is the way of Jesus. Right? So, two things. You want to bring the mercy of God and the justice of God. That's why I began with that definition. What is messy grace? It is when you, as a church leader, bring the mercy of God and the justice of God upon those, toward those who are far from God. So, the mercy of God, that's the part where we say, we're not here to condemn you. The justice of God is to say, but here's the thing, go your way and sin no more. Yeah, we must call sin, sin, as Jesus did. So we want to address the sin. So how do you bring people who are socially unacceptable through your church doors? I've got some ideas for you, okay? And now I'm speaking to you. This is why I asked who is in the room at the beginning. I'm speaking to you as a practitioner who is a pastor. So if you're in a ministry setting, another ministry setting, I'm sure there could be some principles here for you, but I'm most specifically speaking to those who shepherd a local congregation. How do you do this? Okay, number one, I would tell you this. You must teach on uncomfortable topics. You must teach the Bible. You must bring the Word of God to bear on the issues that the culture is struggling with. If you don't, it will make your people think that the Bible doesn't speak to it, and the Bible does speak to it. So, as an example, I told our congregation that I'm teaching through the book of Genesis, and I've taught through the book of Genesis a couple times before, but I said, I want to tell you, I'm not going to teach it in the way that I taught previously. Last time I taught, maybe 10 years ago, maybe a little bit longer than that. I said, we're not going to talk about the age of the earth. We're not going to talk about dinosaurs. Those things are important. Those are good conversations to have. But we're going to talk about gender and identity. We're going to talk about sexuality. When we get to the Tower of Babel, we're going to talk about transhumanism. Some people in the congregation are like, transhumanism, what is that? How great is it they heard the word transhumanism for the first time where? In their church. Your job is to lead, feed, and protect the congregation. And stay ahead. Stay ahead. Men of Issachar. You familiar with the men of Issachar in the Old Testament? They are defined as men who understood the times. We desperately need more church leaders who understand the times. When I get a phone call from a parent or a grandparent, there's about a 50% chance that their child, their grandchild, is involved in some cultural element that they do not understand, whether it's LGBTQ or some other ideology, and they just don't understand it. And they say, Pastor, I need your help. Lead from the front on this one. Teach on uncomfortable topics. Secondly, tell the stories of life transformation. Jesus was the master storyteller. He told story after story after story. What's important and what's powerful about story? They're relatable. They're relatable. Tell the story. So we have a ministry that serves the homeless. And we just pack simple sandwiches every week. But some weeks we'll feed 1,000 people. 1,000 people a week. And we have a mobile kitchen that goes out into the community. And we discovered, not too far from our church, there was a couple that lived in a tent on the street. And so this couple from our church visited them, gave them some food, got to know them, kept going back, kept feeding them, bringing sandwiches and so forth. It's a young couple, and the woman was pregnant. And she was several months pregnant. And they were struggling. They were both addicted to drugs, living in a tent. Now, if you know anything about Arizona, it's what? It's hot. It's brutally hot. I think 46, 47 degrees Celsius. It's like a pizza oven. It's hot. Okay? They're living in a tent in our city. So this couple visits them and visits them again and feeds them and befriends them. And eventually she gets to the point where she felt God lay it on her heart to say to this pregnant mother, if you need any help with that baby, you let me know. We would be happy to help in any way possible. And fast forward a few weeks later, the woman essentially says to her, I want you to adopt my baby. Well, God had been laying it on the heart of this couple to do just that. They were prepared for that conversation. If she came to us and asked us to adopt her baby, that's what we do. Baby is born. Baby is born addicted to drugs. The parents who are in the tent, have not attended our church yet, but the grandparents have. Why? Because of the compassion from Christians to their children. Parents are still lost. The grandparents have come to church. This tent is in the shadow of my church. That's my problem. As a pastor, as I'm driving around and I see people who are homeless, and there's many, many different reasons for that. And in the United States, there's a sense that we sort of perpetuate homelessness. And so I've met most of the people that are holding the signs. I park my car, I get out, I walk up to them. Here's my card. Here's how I can help you. Are you addicted to drugs? Most of them will say, yes, I'm addicted to drugs. We can help you with that. We partner with a number of different organizations, great ministries. We get them in, we get them shelter, we get them what they need. And that's part of the life transformation. We capture these stories all the time. All the time. One of our core values at our church is transformed lives. If you come to our church, there's going to be some element, something that hits you during our service where you're like, wow, thanks for reminding me that God is in the business of changing lives. Might be a baptism, might be a testimony. You're going to get hit with something, and you're like, then the Spirit of God is in this place. You have to capture those stories. Jesus was a storyteller because story is powerful. Social media knows the power of story. Story is God's invention, not social media's. Reclaim it and use it for the kingdom. We baptize the same-sex attracted and celibate for the glory of God, 18-year-old. We share his story. There's someone sitting in the audience, 34 years old, was raised in the church, came out when he was 17, left, had a bad experience, been gone for 17 years, came back and said, he had two questions for me. What is your position on LGBTQ, and what version of the Bible do you read from? Why did he ask me that? He's been raised in church. I already knew that. Chances are you've been raised in church. By the way, I think that statistic is true because the powers of darkness love to focus on our kids. That's why that statistic is so high. That's why there's a target on the back of the kids in churches. So tell the story. Okay, the third one, and this might be one of the more powerful ones. If you want to create an environment that welcomes messy people, then you have to surround yourself with people who were messy in your leadership, like on your leadership team. If you are in pastoral ministry, hire the people that have unpleasant stories and set them at the highest levels of your organization. When the church was smaller, one of my first hires, maybe my first or second, maybe probably my second hire, was an individual who has gauged ears, covered with tattoos, two sleeves, full tattoos. Not a lot of tattoos over here in Europe, I've noticed. All over in America, everybody's wearing tattoos. Gauged ears, two full sleeves of tattoos, and he has the most tender heart, this man, because of what God has taken him through. Because of the experiences that have happened to him when he was a child. You understand? And very often it's true. Your outward reflection is a response to what's going on inside of you. Your outward appearance is a response, is a reflection of what's going on inside of you. Two gauged ears, big hoops, covered with tattoos. And when I added him to our leadership team, immediately there were some people in our church who said what? Pastor, come here. You know we love you. You know that. And then you know what's coming after that. Yeah. Right? I've been around a long time. You know we love you. And you wish they would say, help me understand. But they don't. They don't. Instead they say, I have a problem. I have a problem. Okay, let's talk about it. Because you see, you have to shepherd them too. In a way, Jesus actually was a shepherd to the Pharisees. Nicodemus comes to him at night. Sure, we'll have this conversation. I can work with this. And the conversation usually goes something like this. Trust me. Give us some time. And I'd love for you to sit across the table from your newest pastor and have a conversation. And then they hear the pastor's heart, and that certainly helps. But what often happens is, and sometimes it takes years in the making, those same people will come to you and say, thank you. Thank you for doing that. You know why? Because that's my son. That's my grandson. And now I know that I can invite them to this church, and they can see somebody and say, wait, that's possible. On your pastoral team, on your leadership team, that's possible. I have a friend who's same-sex attracted. He lived in San Francisco and had a job working in gay bars in San Francisco. Because of the lifestyle, depressed, down and out, wrapped his car around a tree. Two Christians stopped by to help him. They paid him visits in the hospital, and he got saved. And he met his wife, who was a former lesbian. They got married. They have three beautiful boys. I have his website if you want it, loveandtruthnetwork.org. Incredible resource for you, okay? Incredible resource. His name is Gary Ingram. And I tried so badly to get him on my staff. I tried so badly to get this guy on my staff, you know. And I just had lunch with him a month ago, and I'm like, you know, Gary, when you're ready, you're on my team. Because what does that communicate to people, right? There's the story. But here's the thing. Jesus led by example. I'll wash your feet. So if you listen, what's important to your church, just like in your life, you follow your church's checkbook. Where do they spend their money? Who do they hire? Yeah, because that tells you the heart of that church. And so now, this pastor that I described to you, he's one of our most beloved pastors, and if I was to release him, or if he was to leave, I would be in trouble. I would be in trouble. People would be talking to me about it. Where's Pastor so-and-so? We like him. We like him. Because that's my son. That's my grandson. Yeah. And that's the changing nature of the culture, and the church has to stay ahead of it. So, 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Or do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither the sexually immoral nor idolaters. Now, let me just tell you, there's going to be something in this list that gets everybody in the room. And whenever I preach this to the congregation, I say, what I'm about to read, identify what it is for you. Okay? There's something in this list that's going to get you. The sexually immoral, the idolaters. And what is idolatry? We're all guilty of that. That's why it's the very first command. Have no other gods before me. You get that right, you get everything else right. Our art, our hearts, as Tim Keller says, are little idol-making machines. We can take good things, elevate them to the place of supremacy, make them ultimate things. You've just made it an idol. I was talking with a lady last night who was struggling, and she said, I just want God to give me clarity. Give me clarity. Give me clarity. And I said, you know what? I've been there. You know what I realized? I made clarity an idol. Because telling God that I want clarity was my way of saying, God, let me tell you what you need to do for me. Do not be deceived, neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor men who practice homosexuality. It's interesting, it's the practice of homosexuality that's condemned. Nor thieves, nor the greedy. By the way, if people come to you and they say, the Bible affirms homosexuality, there is not one verse in the Bible that is even neutral on the subject. Not even neutral. Nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor men who practice homosexuality, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. So one by one we could go and we could say, okay, this one's me, this one's me. So there's something for everyone. But you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God. So here's what I'm saying to you. On your leadership team, on your pastoral staff, do you have, and such were some of you. Because to the degree that you have a reflection of this, I'm telling you, your church will be unstoppable. On our church's wall, one of our back walls as you leave, is on huge letters on the back wall. It says, Beyond Our Walls. And that's meant to help our people be reminded, when you leave this place, you take your Christian faith with you, and you engage the culture, which is another one of our core values, to engage the culture. And why do we want to engage the culture? For the same reason Daniel did. The same reason Paul, when he's up in Mars Hill, is in Athens. It's a place where all the highest education. Hey, he's very polite. He says, hey, I'm here to tell you something you don't know. See, to an unknown God, let me tell you about the God that you don't know. He's the creator of heaven and earth. In one sentence, he transcended everything that they believed about all of their little gods. The God that you don't know is actually the God that created everything. What's he do? He steps into the culture and he contextualizes the gospel. Churches must be doing that. If you're not doing that, you're behind. And you'll never see these people come across your doorstep.